Good morning, everyone. I'm Fiona Tay on The City and the Street, bringing you the latest financial news on your student radio station, Raw, 12:51 AM. Welcome, freshers, and welcome back to Warwick. I'm the first Raw program of the year, and settling back into campus makes us all reluctant to start work. But recruitment season is round the corner for spring and summer finance hopefuls. So tune in every Monday, 10 AM on Raw, 12:51 AM, radio.warwick.ac.uk, to brush up on market events with me, Fiona Tay, on The City and the Street.
Oceans apart and it's heavy on my heart. Roll in a roll, but my rolling came too slow. I'm happy, you know. I'm spending my time watching the ship and the globe. The beauties and the simple things. Your sweetness and your elegance. I'm happy, you know.
Celebrating the University of Warwick's 50th anniversary.
The Festival of the Imagination.
Join the University on the 16th and 17th of October for what is set to be a truly memorable festival for students and families.
Across campus, there'll be talks and demonstrations on a wide variety of topics from leading experts.
Don't miss appearances from acclaimed screenwriter Andrew Davies, writer and comedian A.L. Kennedy, and former BBC correspondent Torrin Douglas.
Join us down on a packed piazza for an array of live music and market stalls, including food from the award-winning Cinnamon Kitchen.
Outside the Arts Centre, there'll be a collection of classic cars, whilst inside the Butterworth Hall, meet some of Warwick's amazing researchers and explore the free interactive discovery zone.
Best of all, entrance is free. Just don't forget to book tickets online for certain talks at warwick.ac.uk/warwick50.
The festival opens on Friday the 16th of October, 4 till 10 PM, and Saturday the 17th of October, 9:30 AM till 10 PM.
The Festival of the Imagination.
Imagine the future.
It's 5th October 2015, 10:05 AM, and here is your morning briefing. This morning at 9 AM, the Eurozone service sector's PMI was released. Eurozone services sector ends third quarter on a very dull note. Growth in the Eurozone waned at the end of the third quarter, and a final reading of the Eurozone services PMI for September, a key survey of activity, has been revised down to 53.7 from an initial estimate of 54. This represents a fairly sizable fall in the pace of growth from autumn, when the services PMI recorded a reading of 54.4, although it is still well above the 50 mark that divides contraction and growth. This pushed the composite PMI, which tracks both the services and manufacturing industries, down to 53.6 from 54.3 in August. Chris Williamson, chief economist at Market, which produces the PMI surveys, said he expects third quarter growth in the Eurozone to come in at 0.4%, in line with the second quarter, but down from 0.5% in the first 3 months of the year. He said the final PMI reading came in slightly below earlier flash estimate, but still leaves signs of the Eurozone economy having expanded 0.4% in the third quarter. However, the failure of the economy to pick up speed over the summer will be a disappointment to the ECB, especially with job creation sliding to an eighth-month low. The weakening of the pace of expansion in September raises the risk of growth fading further in the fourth quarter, which would in turn boost the likelihood of the ECB opening the QE taps further. Within the Eurozone, a final reading of the German services PMI has been downgraded to 54.1 from an initial flash reading published last month of 54.3. This was lower than the 54.9 reading recorded in August. However, France's services sector, which covers everything from shops to hotels to accountants, had a good month in September. A final reading of the services PMI was on Monday improved to 51.9 from an initial flash reading of 51.2, which was higher than 50.6 recorded in August. And at 9:30 a.m, the UK services PMI was released, UK entering fourth quarter at a pace of just 0.3%. The latest Purchasing Managers Index for Britain's powerhouse services sector has confirmed most economists' expectations that the UK GDP growth has moderated in the third quarter, but market is also highlighting an even slower start to the fourth quarter, as confidence is knocked by concerns over the wider global economy. Chris Williamson said that the UK economy has just started fourth quarter at a very slow pace. Weakness is spreading from the struggling manufacturing sector, hitting transport and other industrial-related services in particular. There are also signs that consumers have been more cautious and are pulling back on their leisure spending, such as on restaurants and hotels. Wider business service sector confidence has meanwhile also been knocked by global economic worries and financial market jitters. The UK economy expanded at a rate of 0.7% in the second quarter, but Mr. Williamson expects third quarter GDP figures to show expansion of 0.5% between July and September. And Glencore shares have been swinging in early trading. Glencore's Hong Kong listed shares surged as much as 71.6% in Asian trading and has jumped 30% since London opened this morning. The world overnight session in Asia and a hefty jump in London trading comes on reports that the company is open to a takeover, with the two main buyers being Temasek Holdings, the sovereign wealth fund of Singapore, and Mitsubishi Bank, the Japanese bank. Glencore itself sounds bemused, denying knowledge of any reasons for these price and volume movements.
Ready, oh, ready. Want to learn the difference between Arrabbiata and El Fresco? Say Alvida Saint to Tete en l'air with a course at the Language Centre. Beginner or advanced, you can study courses on French, Spanish, Arabic, and more as part of your degree with no extra cost, or separately in one of our lifelong learning courses. Come along to the Language Centre on the ground floor of the Humanities Building between 10 and 4 on the 7th, 8th and 9th of October to enrol on one of our academic courses. Or for one of our lifelong learning courses, come and see us by the 16th of October. Visit warwick.ac.uk/language centre for more information.
On markets data this morning, the Dow Jones Index has increased 1.23% at 16,472. The US S&P 500 increased 1.43% at 1,951.36. The UK FTSE 100 increased 1.93% at 6,249.47. The Japan Nikkei 225 increased 1.58% at 18,005.49. The Stocks Europe 600 increased 2.20% at 355.53. And the Hang Seng Index increased by, 1.62% at 21,855. Key global benchmarks. In bonds and rates, 10-year U.S. government bonds decreased 0.16% at 1.99% yield. 10-year U.K. government gilts increased 0.29% at 1.71% yield. 10-year Eurozone bonds decreased 0.14% at 0.53%. In currencies, euro per dollar decreased 0.15% at 0.6575. Euro per dollar decreased 0.40% at 0.8881. Pound per dollar decreased by 0.15% at 0.6575. Euro per pound decreased 0.17% at 1.3515. Dollar per yen decreased 0.16% at 0.0083. In commodities, Brent crude stands at $48.75 a barrel, an increase of 1.29%. WTI crude is at $46.07 a barrel at 1.16% increase. 100-ounce gold decreased 0.30% at $1,134. Corn increased 0.45% at $391, and wheat increased by 0.54% at $516.
a trick of mine? Did I make you shake your knees? Did I make him spill his wine? Lord, I'm spreading like disease. No, I'm all up in your mind. Oh, Lucifer's inside. Oh, Lucifer's inside. Oh, did you hear the rain? Oh, the rain. Ooh. You can try and run and hide. Tearing at the chain. Means I'm coming home again. Means I'm coming home, my friend. Oh, Lucifer's inside. Oh, Lucifer's inside. Lucifer's inside.
Do you love film? Join us at the award-winning Warwick Student Cinema. Become a member to enjoy the latest blockbusters, independent films, and certified classics, all for outstanding value.
Surely you can't be serious.
Or join our volunteer crew and see everything for free.
Are you kidding me right now?
You could learn the art of projection or join our front of house and marketing teams. For more information, head to filmsoc.warwick.ac.uk.
Alrighty then.
Treasuries jump after soft U.S. data released. U.S. non-farm payrolls rose 142,000 last month, some way short of the consensus forecast, and August reading was revised downwards. The jobless rate held at 5.1%, but perhaps most worrying was news that average earnings growth stagnated at an annual rate of 2.2%. Treasury bonds and gold jumped while the dollar slipped as soft U.S. employment report prompted participants to push back their expectations for when the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates. U.S. and European equities and commodity prices staged strong recoveries in losses incurred after the release of the data. In New York, the S&P 500 fell as much as 1.6% in early trade, but turned that decline into a 1.4% rise to 1,951 by the close. That left the index up 1% over last week. The CBOE VIX Volatility Index, the so-called equity fear gauge that measures the market's expectations of stock market volatility over the next 30-day period, was down 7% in late trade Friday at 20.98, but still above the 20 level considered to be a signal of stress in the market. The pan-European FTSE Eurofirst 300 also swung into the red following the release of jobs figures, but it too rallied to end 0.5% higher on Friday, but was still down 0.2% over the five-day period. The labour data kept a volatile week in which there was little respite from concerns over the outlook for global growth and inflation. Interest rate futures moved to price in at a 29% chance of the US central bank raising rates for the first time in a decade in December, down from 43% on Thursday, according to Bloomberg calculations. The chances of a move this month tumbled to just 8%. The yield on a policy-sensitive two-year US Treasury notes, which moves inversely to its price, was down 7 basis points to 0.58% and 12 beats down on the week. Just a fortnight ago, it hit a four-year high of 0.82% yield. The 10-year yield was 6 bips lower at 1.98%, while the equivalent maturity, German Bund yield, fell 4 bips at 0.51% after touching 0.48%, a level not seen since June when the threat of a Brexit and Greek default was at its peak. Industrial commodities managed to shake off worries over headwinds facing global growth, which were highlighted by disappointing September manufacturing data out of the US and China. The US Institute for Supply Management Manufacturing Index fell to its lowest since May 2013, while official figures from China showed factory activity contracting for a second successive month. But Brent oil recovered from an early fall on Friday to settle for 0.9% higher on $48.13 a barrel, but was still 1% down on the week. Copper steadied in London after sliding to $5,010 a ton after the release of the jobs data, closing barely changed on the data that was $5,100. The metal hit a one-month low of $4,915 on Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's 10:26 a.m. and I'm Fiona Tay on The City and the Street, Raw, 12:51 a.m. Here are some snippets from morning headlines in early London and Asia trading. China consumer apps burn out in price war. Scores of online to offline apps which offer online booking of everything from manicures and food delivery to taxi rides have folded in recent weeks after running out of cash and failing to raise more funds. Prospects look rocky for Southeast Asia deals. Southeast Asia is likely to end the year with one of the worst performances for deal-making activity since the global financial crisis, but bankers say the trend should be short-lived. Glencore oil deals could bite banks. A Glencore oil pact with Chad last year and troubles with other similar deals are shedding light on how the company's energy business has taken some banks into risky areas that are causing jitters as commodity prices fall. Commodity slide threatens emerging market debt. Many investors fear that emerging market companies will suffer rising defaults on their foreign currency bonds because of the commodity bust and drops in local currency. HSBC dividend debtors are in for a surprise. The UK-based Hong Kong bank has one of the highest yields in the sector but don't plan on cut on dividends. Services survey has said a lot this morning, as I previously mentioned, on both Eurozone and UK PMI. Jobs number leaves Fed in the keeling yields. A weak September employment report doesn't mean the job market is in trouble, but investors aren't taking any chances. New liquidity rules will make fund managers more chicken-hearted. Just about everybody has been worrying lately about whether mutual funds and ETFs are equipped to withstand the next stock market crash or bond collapse. A new rule should make funds safer and most fund managers meeker. Corporate bond boom on borrowed time. Low rates have been a boon for corporate bond markets. Every party has to end sometime though. Analysts are forecasting that this boom will end before the end of 2015. Omaha beat by ConAgra. Omaha still punches above its weight in the corporate world but received a body blow this week from ConAgra. By deciding to move to Chicago, the food company reduced Nebraska's 30 number of Fortune 500 companies to 4. And next, on the downgrading of ASEAN potential. Last week, the Asian Development Bank downgraded the 2015-2016 growth forecast for most ASEAN countries and the region as a whole. The latest revised figures revealed some of the risks that continue to challenge growth prospects in the region. Sub-regional growth has been revised down to 4.4% from an initial forecast of 4.9% owing to various domestic factors such as disappointing growth in Thailand, slow government spending in Indonesia and the Philippines, wavering business confidence in Malaysia, and external shocks such as falling global energy prices and slowing growth in China. Here are five main risks threatening growth in ASEAN. Number 1. Internal political struggles. Asian Development Bank, ADB, has reported slowed government as well as waning business confidence. Indonesia is dealing with a political struggle between the ruling coalition and opposition camp in the House of Representatives. This in turn has hampered projections for government infrastructure spending for as much as 2015. Similarly, public spending will gradually accelerate, but is expected to miss government targets. Furthermore, due to a lack of unity within his administration, President Joko Jokowi Widodo has recently reshuffled his cabinet, adding to the political uncertainty. Thailand's level of public spending is recovering from the political disruptions in 2014 and has started to pick up this year, but projections still lag behind goals. The 1MBD scandal in Malaysia has led to a massive depreciation of the ringgit and has undermined business confidence. Secondly, elections generate post-election uncertainties. November elections in Myanmar and 2016 elections in the Philippines also add to the uncertainty to the growth prospects of those countries. The ADB sees greater than usual uncertainty for the Philippines. Business is concerned as to whether a new administration would continue with the current economic reform agendas. Particular concern exists in the infrastructure, social welfare and energy sectors, where the current administration has made significant progress. In the case of Myanmar, businesses are concerned about who will be president following the historic election in November this year. The role of the military is expected to remain dominant, while Aung San Suu Kyi, though constitutionally barred from the highest post, is expected to see her party, NLD, perform well. Hence, the power struggle between the military and pro-democracy political parties will persist, affecting political stability and economic performance. Third, droughts and floods hurt agriculture. Southeast Asia is one of the world's most disaster-prone regions, yet is also heavily reliant on agriculture. Floods and droughts caused by El Nino in several Southeast Asian countries have hurt the agricultural sector. Myanmar has experienced the worst floods in decades this year and is expected to see both production and export reductions for rice and other crops. In Thailand, drought has hit an agricultural output hard. With declining rural incomes and high household debt, private consumption in 2015 will be slow. Similarly, Indonesia is suffering from its worst drought since 2010, with as much as 80% of the country affected. The Philippines also saw no year-on-year growth in agriculture production in the first half of 2015. Drought conditions in Vietnam have also damaged coffee and rice production, and if prolonged, could further weaken growth in the agricultural sector while pushing up food prices into 2016. 4. Low energy prices retard government revenues. Fallen prices for energy and other commodities have also hurt the growth of some ASEAN countries. Low oil and gas prices have crumpled government income in Brunei, which relies on hydrocarbons for two-thirds of its GDP. The ADB has reported that export revenue for crude oil, refined petroleum products and liquefied natural gas in Malaysia plummeted, the result of a steep drop in oil and gas prices. 5. Slow growth in China hurts ASEAN. The ADB has also cut the growth forecast from China from 7.2% in March down to 6.8% for 2015, and from 7% to 6.7% for 2016. China is the largest trading partner for many Southeast Asian countries and the largest partner for ASEAN as a whole. Weak demand from China has undermined export performances in many Southeast Asian countries. We can see a trend of how Southeast Asian countries switched their main trading partner from US to China in 2007, and now they're starting to switch back. However, optimism remains. While the ADB has slashed growth forecast for the region in 2016, it expects growth to rebound in 2016 to 4.9% with improvement in exports and accelerated infrastructure spending. The inauguration of the ASEAN Economic Community at the end of this year will also see a strengthening of trade links between member countries and a step towards an integrated market. Tourism, one of the vital industries in many Southeast Asian countries, has also remained resilient and continues to drive growth, particularly in Thailand, Cambodia, and the Philippines.
Tell me. another, die for each other. We're cool for the summer.
And watch online at radio.warwick.ac.uk.
From SUHQ,
this is your Raw.
Oh, my love, let me be your fire. We're a thousand miles up and I'm about to get higher. Feel my heart beating out my chest. You're the only prayer I need to make me feel blessed. Singing, oh, oh.
Feel blessed singing.
Oh, my love, let me be your flower.
make me feel blessed.
I'm Fiona Tay on Raw 12:51 AM, The City and the Street. I have with me the full PMIs for Europe. In Italy, September's services PMI has been estimated to be 54.1. France's final September services PMI is at 51.2. And France's final September composite PMI at 51.4. Germany final September services PMI at 54.3. Germany final September composite PMI at 54.3. Eurozone final September services PMI at 54. Final composite PMI at 53.9. Eurozone October Centix investor confidence estimated at 11.8, previously 13.6. UK services PMI at 56, prior 55.6. UK composite PMI at 54.9 after previously estimated 55.1. Eurozone August retail sales month on month increased 0%. And Eurozone August retail sales year on year increased 1.7%. And in equities, student loan company in US, Sophie, backs a $3.8 billion value. Sophie, a US student loan company, has beefed up its $1 billion funding round, adding an additional $100 million to satisfy investors who have valued the company just shy of $38 billion, according to a person with knowledge of the matter reported on Bloomberg. The company's core business is student loans, but it has expanded into mortgages and is planning to offer credit cards and deposit accounts that pay interest. If everybody is getting less than what they want, the solution is to take in a little bit more, the person said in regards to Sophie. Will all majors be able to shield their dividends? It is the last nettle energy companies want to grasp, but cutting their dividends is a growing risk if oil prices languish further, especially since OPEC is joining in on the price war. In the wake of a near 60% drop in crude since June 2014, energy companies have cut costs, slashed their capital budgets and axed more than 100,000 jobs globally, but few have cut or even frozen their dividends. Indeed, ConocoPhillips announced a modest increase to its dividend in July. Rand Lance, the company's chief executive, kicked off his second quarter earnings call a few weeks later by saying, "The dividend is safe." Let me repeat, the dividend is safe. All companies have made concerted effort to shield dividends because payouts are a significant factor for income-hungry investors to buy, even as the energy sector has taken a hit. The S&P 500 energy sector has already declined 40% since June last year. The dividend yield for oil companies is at a record high, averaging about 6%, with Shell commanding the highest 8.2%. The S&P 500 energy sector has a current dividend yield of 3.7% compared with a 2.2% dividend yield on a broader benchmark, S&P 500. Energy only just lags the 3.82% dividend yield on the utility sector, a favorite for income investors. For now, investment boutique Oppenheimer forecasts that most of the major oil companies will lift their dividends. It estimates ExxonMobil capital spending will drop 11% this year from a year ago, while its dividend will climb 4%. Similarly, they expect BP's capital spending to drop 19% over the same period, while its dividend will increase 6%. There's a good reason for energy companies to put the barricades up around their dividends. In July, Lin Energy, an oil and gas natural company, said it would recommend suspending its dividend on the end of the third quarter. The news, which accompanied disappointing results, sent its shares down 26%. But it is increasingly unlikely that the dividend persistence will last. All oil and gas companies are currently funding the dividend through additional borrowing, but that cannot be sustained infinitely. And unless oil prices rebound meaningfully in the next 6 to 12 months, the probability of an industry-wide dividend and valuation adjustment has significantly increased. Chinese consumer apps burn out in price war. Scores of offline to offline apps fold after running out of cash and failing to raise more. For several months this year, Chinese smartphone app Car8 delivered car wash services to users in Beijing for a low price of 10 yuan, approximately $1.57. a hefty discount on the usual 20 to 30 yuan price. The cost to Car 8 for each car wash was 17 yuan, but the hope was to build a base of loyal companies and then be able to phase out the discounts. But in July, Car 8 folded, as have scores of similar apps in recent weeks after it ran out of cash and failed to raise more funds. You need a humongous user base to cover the cost of operating the business, said Car 8 founder Liu Qiang. The failure of Car 8 reflects the shakeout that is hitting one of the hottest segments in China's booming startup scene. Dubbed online to offline, or O2O for short, these businesses offer online booking of services as diverse as manicures, food delivery and taxi rides, similar to what is known as on-demand services in the US. But while the lure of such services in the US is largely for convenience, in China it is bargains. A Subway tuna sandwich and drink on food delivery app LA Me cost 9 yuan including delivery, versus 31 yuan at the nearest Subway shop. A karaoke room can be reserved on group discount site Meituan at just 58 yuan for 8 hours of singing, a 90% discount off the original 560 yuan price. In most cases, when apps connect users to brick-and-mortar services, the merchant gets paid full price, while the app covers the difference, often with venture capital funds that until recently were pouring into China's startups. These huge bargains made O2O apps a feature of life for many Chinese. On an average Friday, Beijing news editor Yu Xi, 25 years old, says she uses phone apps to hail a ride to her office, order dumplings for lunch and coffee during the afternoon, and hunt for deals for dinner and a movie. In a McKinsey survey in February, 71% of Chinese online consumers reported that they use O2O apps. However, the recent Chinese stock market swings and increasing concerns over slow economic growth have made venture capitalists nervous about the high rate at which O2O startups have been burning through cash, and some investors are pulling the plug. Venture capital firm Gobi Partners Inc., which has invested in apps across sectors including real estate, auto repair, and food delivery, estimates that 30 to 40% of O2O startups have shut down in the past few months. Ken Shi, a partner at the firm, said roughly half the money such startups raise have been used for subsidies to attract customers. List of dozens of failed O2O startups are circulating in Chinese media. Websites of companies namely carry error messages or notices announcing that the services have been suspended. To be sure, for a number of apps and businesses that still have funding, what is an unprofitable business model now still holds promise well over China's largest cities. Meituan.com, a leading competitor, expects to raise more than $2 billion in its current round of funding, valuing the company at more than $10 billion US dollars, said Wang Huiwen, a vice president at the startup. China's deep-pocketed internet companies, Alibaba Group Holding Limited, Baidu Inc., and Tencent Holdings Limited, have all staked claims in the sector and continue to see great potential for growth. In terms, the market hasn't been grabbed yet. It is a blue ocean, said Zeng Liang, Baidu's vice president in charge of its group buying platform, Nuomi. Baidu, too, has spent on subsidies. Mr. Zeng said that such company also draws on user behavior data and its own mapping tool to make better recommendations to users. Baidu has invested in apps for dining, delivery and entertainment services and estimates the total value of O2O apps at 10 trillion yuan this year. It expects the market to double in 4 to 5 years and plans to invest more than $3.2 billion in services apps over 3 years.
When the summer deal, I felt pressure. Don't wanna see the numbers, I wanna see heaven. You say, could you write a song for me? I say, I'm sorry about you that I believe. When I go home, I tend to close the door. I never want to know. So sing with me, can't you see? I don't have. I do it for love.
This is Fiona on Raw at 12:51 a.m., the city and the street. After last week ended with a disappointing U.S. jobs report for September, further reducing expectations for a Fed liftoff, this week we'll have a focus on the health of corporate America as third quarter earnings seasons kick off. Here's what to expect over this week. In Fed minutes, after policymakers at the U.S. Federal Reserve voted to keep central banks' key interest rate a record low last month, investors will pass through the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee's September meeting, which are released on Wednesday. Officials added a new line to their statement highlighting the headwinds from recent global economic and financial developments, and any further insights on how they evaluate the global backdrop will be scrutinized by investors. In central banks, the Fed isn't the only central bank on the calendar. Tomorrow, Australian Central Bank announces their rate decisions. On Wednesday, the Bank of Japan is expected to maintain the size of its current stimulus measures unchanged, though Governor Haruhiko Kuroda will likely be pressed on the recent signs of deflation re-emerging at a press conference. The Bank of England is also expected to leave its key rate unchanged at a record low of 0.5%, though the recent tone of the Monetary Policy Committee could sound hawkish to some. I would interpret as the MPC wanting to lean against some recent market expectations of it pushing back the date of its first hike into 2017. U.S. earnings. Aluminium maker Alcoa unofficially kicks off third quarter U.S. earnings seasons on Thursday. Earnings at S&P 500 companies are expected to have dropped 4.8% from a year ago, while revenues are forecast to have dropped 1%, according to S&P Capital IQ. In the IMF and the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank hold their annual meetings in Lima, Peru next week. IMF Director Christine Lagarde and the World Bank President Jim Yong Kim will hold press conferences on Thursday, and the IMF publishes its World Economic Outlook on Tuesday. Look out for follow-up reports next week Monday, 10 a.m. with me on The City and the Street. In the last sector, Trading 101, what should we trade this week? As global markets continue to sell off, investors should be looking for stocks with strong fundamentals and relatively low risk. Whether or not a market bottom is in sight, it is prudent to have a shopping list of stocks to buy in an oversold environment. Presenting Apple Inc. Traded on the Nasdaq with ticker AAPL, I'd be hard-pressed to find a Warwick student who hasn't heard of Apple, but let's hear it from an equity point of view. Apple has become something of a punching bag of late, with fears of a China slowdown casting a shadow over the company. There is also a growing sentiment that the company Steve Jobs built into a wellspring of innovation might have lost its mojo. But the iPhone is now nearly a decade old, yet it still remains Apple's primary cash cow. Guess what? I don't care. Even if Apple never invents a major new product again, the stock is still attractive at today's prices. AAPL stock trades at a very modest forward price to equity of 11.5, and if you strip out the roughly $35 per share in cash and investments, you get a forward PE of 7.9. That is absolutely cheap. Meanwhile, Apple is quickly evolved into a shareholder-friendly dividend-raising machine. Its current dividend yield is at a modest 1.8%, but the company has proven its mettle as a hiker. Since initiating its quarterly dividend in 2012 at 37.9 cents, Apple has bumped it up by 37%, and if the stock price slides much further, you can bet that Icon will be agitating for another large stock buyback. Furthermore, the recent rollout of the iPhone 6S, paired with the fact that only a small portion of iPhone 5 users have yet to upgrade to the iPhone 6, it should pave the way for another record-breaking holiday season for Apple. Though Apple is highly exposed to the Chinese consumer, many industry analysts would argue that Apple's products, especially the iPhone, should be considered consumer staples, and that the iPhone company's sales are hardly a function of the underlying economic environment. Apple has successfully created a strong ecosystem among its various products and platforms, which gives an incentive to marginal consumer to repeatedly buy and use iOS devices and products. Basic financials, Apple has a net profit margin of 22.60% and has been profitable for the previous 5 fiscal years. It has experienced 37.80% annualized earnings per share growth and 33.60% annualized sales growth for the past 5 years, and has a forward PE of 11.30. Apple Inc. has a dividend yield of 1.88%, and I would consider it a staple in most investor stocks' shopping lists, especially in the consumer electronics industry. I say buy. And that's all for today. Thank you for staying with me. I'm Fiona Tay on The City and the Street. See you next week. It's 11 a.m.
Come around, I know you've been lost. I'm glad you got found, 'cause I've been a little lost myself.